Hello, hello, and welcome back to Glycan Hub, the podcast in which we explore health, disease, and longevity through the lens of glycobiology. My name is Rina, and I am your host. In a world reshaped by COVID-19, recognizing the intricacies of our immune response to such threats and understanding how our lifestyle choices can tip the scale between vulnerability and resilience in the face of future pandemics has never been more imperative. As listeners of our podcast, you'll already know that chronological and biological ages do not always progress at the same pace. And one of the primary determinants of one's biological age is the level of low-grade chronic inflammation in the body. Glycans on immunoglobulin G, the most abundant antibody in humans, are considered functional effectors which can either promote or suppress inflammation. My guest today has conducted numerous studies looking at IgG glycans of individuals infected with COVID-19 and then tracking the severity of their symptoms. What he found is that there is no such thing as a standard human. There is a multitude of factors which should be considered before giving generalized advice about disease prevention and implementation of one-size-fits-all restrictions. In fact, the glycans on IgG could predict how severely the patients were going to be affected by COVID-19, which offers hope that such measurements could one day be used as prognostic biomarkers and tools for better patient stratification. In this episode, we're offering a retrospective on COVID-19. We're not only comparing the different national responses, but also discussing the role of media in propagating misinformation and contemplating the strategies we could employ to better prepare for future pandemics. My guest today is a professor of biochemistry and molecular biology at the University of Zagreb, Faculty of Pharmacy and Biochemistry, and founder and CEO of Genos. He is also the Chief Scientific Officer at Glycan Age. His lab performs large-scale studies on the human glycome and gene-wide associations, aiming to understand the role of protein glycosylation in health and disease. His work primarily focuses on plasma glycoproteins and immunoglobulin G in particular. A warm welcome to Gordon Lautz. Hello and welcome to our podcast.
Hi, Rina. Thank you for the invitation.
So we are going to be discussing your research in COVID over the last 3 years, but I think a good place to start is by to set the stage by first talking about inflammation and discussing some of the key terminology when it comes to the immune system. Glycans coat our cells. They are present on most proteins in our body. So why do you choose to study glycan composition of immunoglobulin G or IgG antibodies in particular?
Antibodies or immunoglobulins have a very important role in our immune system. And glycans have a very important role on antibodies. So normally we think about antibodies as a tool, as a weapon which will recognize the foreign antigen, foreign molecules or foreign organisms. But after antibodies bind to a foreign antigen, immune system has to mobilize some form of responses. Different molecular events which will lead to destruction of that antigen. And this form of response depends on a type of an antigen. So we'll have a different immune reaction to a virus, to a bacteria, or to some kind of a dietary antigen. And this response is by large defined by glycans. Because the antigen part, the so-called FAB or fragment antigen binding of antibodies is defined very early in our lifetime. So we have all these recombinations, we generate the sequence of amino acids early, then there is fine tuning later, but in principle our repertoire is set early, before we meet the antigen. So the decision what to do with the antigen has to be made later in life. So once we meet an antigen. And actually it can change with time. So we can, for example, induce tolerance to some antigens, or we can develop allergy to some antigens later. And by large, this is done by glycans. So glycans are so-called post-translational modifications. They're added to antibodies after the protein part is defined. And they change the structure of the so-called Fc domain, or the constant.
Fragment crystallizable.
Yeah, it's called fragment crystallizable because we could crystallize it in a lab, because it has the same sequence in all antibodies. Variable regions have different sequence. But it's also called the constant domain because it doesn't change from antibody to antibody. And this constant domain is binding to different receptors, which then activate the immune response. And adding glycans to immunoglobulins can either promote or suppress inflammatory response to a given antigen. This is why it is very important.
So now I think some people might be wondering if the role of antibodies, if they have a role to play in inflammation, why is it negative to have a pro-inflammatory antibody if they would induce inflammation? Shouldn't we want to have the best response possible?
Yes, but against the dangerous antigens. We do not want to have inflammatory response to the molecules which do not cause any, which are not a threat to us. So immune system has a very delicate role to distinguish between antigens and molecules which are dangerous and those which are not dangerous. So yes, we would like to have the most efficient response in, for example, antibodies against the virus. We want to eliminate the virus. But in the same time, we do not want these antibodies to bind to some other parts of our body and then cause inflammation in other parts, because then we call this autoimmune diseases. So the balance between the adequate immunity and destroying the pathogen and autoimmunity is extremely sensitive and dynamic. So we need to optimize our response to an antigen to have maximal benefit for the entire organism. So sometimes we want antibodies to elicit full-scale immune response, to kill everything around. For example, this happens when the cell is infected with the virus. Cell is producing viruses, and then our immune system will kill the entire cell to stop it from producing more viruses. And this is good. But if our immune system is making a mistake and is killing our own cells, we can have very serious diseases. So inflammation is sometimes good and sometimes it is bad. And in particular, it becomes bad as we get older. Because one thing we should always keep in mind is that our genome is optimized for a lifespan of maybe 35 years. Because this was the period until when humans were getting offsprings, until maybe 100, 150 years ago. So nothing in our genome is optimized to keep us alive after the age of 35. And then the damages start to accumulate. And one of these long-term damages is the low-grade chronic inflammation. So inflammation gets out of control. Instead of doing a very important task of destroying pathogens, inflammation starts to cause small little damages all around our body, which then needs to be repaired, which costs a huge amount of energy. And ultimately, it's involved in development of most chronic diseases we have today. So inflammation is underlying cancer, metabolic diseases, diabetes, inflammatory diseases. So too much inflammation is actually what is making us age faster and eventually die.
Excellent. Thank you for introducing the idea of chronic inflammation. In one of your studies, you stated that people with severe COVID-19 had an older IgG glycan composition. What is meant by this?
So this is something actually David Sinclair and I speculated in, I think, March, April 2020, when there were initial data showing that COVID is primarily dangerous for the older population, while the young people mostly do not have any serious consequences. We said, yes, but age is not a number of times that the Earth circles around the sun. This is how we measure age, because we count it in years. But on a biological level, at the level of the molecules, this does not have to be, these two ages, biological and chronological, do not have to go in parallel. And we know that some people age much faster, and some people will be old in their 50s, while other people will be young in their 70s. And there are even some diseases where people would age rapidly and they would be old at the age of 15 or something like that. So then we speculated that molecules which measure biological age, and one of these molecules are glycans, could be better biomarkers for people at high risk of severe COVID than just the chronological age. And this we published as an editorial in Aging, I think in April 2020. At that time, this was a speculation. But later, maybe half a year later, we managed to analyze a number of cohorts of patients all around Europe which had either severe or mild disease. And we did see that people who had a higher glycan age or the more pro-inflammatory IgG glycan composition were more likely to develop severe disease than the people with a younger IgG glycan. And this was on top of chronological age. So when you correct for chronological age, people at, 60 chronological, if they would have an older glycan, they had higher probability to get a severe COVID than people who had a younger IgG glycan.
Now, we are going to focus on disease severity and COVID. And I think a good idea would be just to define what we mean by asymptomatic, mild, moderate, different levels of severity. So if you don't mind, I have taken these from one of your studies and I can read them out so our listeners know what we mean when we refer to them. So by asymptomatic, we mean individuals who are seropositive for COVID-19 but have no symptoms. Seropositive meaning they have COVID-specific antibodies. Mild are individuals with no evidence of pneumonia but who have typical clinical manifestations such as coughing, fever, loss of taste and smell, and so on. Moderate are individuals with pneumonia. Severe are individuals with need of hospital intensive care unit and need of intensive invasive mechanical ventilation. And critical are individuals with need of immediate invasive mechanical ventilation and admission to hospital intensive care unit, or those who have deceased during the hospitalization. Now, I imagine a great priority when designing these studies is it identifying patients in whom COVID-19 was the main disease. So the severity of their symptoms could not be attributed to any other pre-existing illness. How was this distinction made?
So this was actually one of the most difficult things we had to do in doing that study, because unfortunately on a global level, we still have problems in distinguishing people who are in hospital because of the infection with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and people who are in hospital because of some other diseases, but they just got positive for a SARS-CoV-2 virus. And globally, there is no solution for that. So what we did in our study, we went in an extremely conservative way. So we collected blood samples for thousands of patients because, all around the world, there were so many people infected. But then we went very deeply into their clinical conditions, and we eliminated from a study all people with cancers, with active cardiometabolic diseases. So everybody who would be hospitalized because of their other conditions, we just eliminated them from a study. So we really tried to focus only on people where COVID was the reason for hospitalization. And I think this was very important because, especially now, I think now over 80% of hospitalized patients would be hospitalized because of other diseases, and they would just randomly have a SARS-CoV-2 virus. So we had a clinician specialist who was actually working in intensive care unit, going in the individual documentation of every patient to see when was that patient hospitalized, when was the patient infected, because many patients were actually infected during hospitalization. So if they were already in hospital and they got the COVID later, it's really hard to know whether it's the virus or the disease which is causing problems. So we only looked at the people who were more or less healthy. It's hard to define healthy when somebody is 80 or 75, but who did not have severe condition which would require hospitalization before, and then after infection with the virus, they ended up in a hospital, and then either they had a moderate trajectory, severe, or the terminal outcome. And then we compared how do glycans look and what happens with the glycans in these different disease scenarios.
And what did you find when comparing mild and severe patients with mild severe and severe COVID?
So initially, we saw this predisposition element. So people who were more pro-inflammatory at the beginning, they did have a higher disease risk of getting more severe disease. But also what we noticed that the IgG glycan composition was changing during the disease. Because one of the roles of IgG glycans is to modulate inflammation. So it's kind of a signaling mechanism which we don't fully understand. But for example, we know if you take immunoglobulins from a young person and give it to an old person, it's generally suppressing inflammation. This is so-called IVIG therapy. So we looked longitudinally. So we are collecting samples every few days in hospitalized patients. And then we realized that people with the worst outcome had very rapid changes towards the pro-inflammatory IgG glycan. So people who made kind of a mistake of making all their immunoglobulins pro-inflammatory most frequently died. So obviously the decision of the immune system to make all immunoglobulins pro-inflammatory somehow was a risk factor, which is logical because most of people who died of COVID didn't die because of viral activity. They died because of response of the immune system, which then caused lung inflammation and the lungs were filled with the fluid and they were not functioning, and people eventually died because of that. So the role of immunoglobulins to suppress inflammation seems to be very important for a good outcome.
A term that's commonly heard when talking about severe COVID is cytokine storm. Could you explain what it means and how pro-inflammatory antibodies might impact it?
So the cytokines are signaling molecules. They're released by the cells of the immune system, they activate other cells of the immune system, and there is this pro-inflammatory cascade which is activating the immune system to its full extent. To understand it, we have to think about what our immune system normally does. So the normal function of the immune system is, for example, we have some kind of a cut in our skin, bacteria comes in, they start to multiply, and they treat us as food. So these bacteria think we are food and they multiply like crazy. And then what we do, we send all our arsenal of different weapons, the neutrophils, the antibodies, and innate immune system there. And many of these weapons we have are not smart weapons. They're dumb weapons. They destroy everything they see. And this is what kept us alive for a million years. So if you have a cut and then you have some kind of swelling around and there is war going on, you kill some of your cells, you rebuild the new ones, and everything is fine. So immune system is always overreacting. So when there is a threat, it wants to kill everything. But it also has to be controlled. So we have a control mechanism which are suppressing this inflammation. So the cytokine storm is the mechanism which is activating the immune response. So when there is a cytokine storm, if it's local, you could have a very rapid local swelling. You know, sometimes your hand will be twice the size of normal. But then in a few days, this calms down. The problem is if something like that happens in your lungs. Because if your lungs get fully inflamed, they cannot perform the function and then you cannot live. We do not fully understand all aspects of the glycans in the suppression of the immune system. We still need to do a lot of research, but there is a lot of evidence suggesting that IgG glycans are one of the signaling mechanisms used to suppress inflammation. So normally young people have this very efficiently, so they can have very rapid inflammatory response. We know that children react like crazy on some kind of infections or even minor inflammatory events, but then they suppress this inflammation very rapidly. So there is a burst of inflammation and then shutting down the inflammation. And older people both react slower, but also suppress the inflammation slower. And this is very individual. So this IgG glycan can be, there are people who are 40-something with IgG glycan, which is similar to people of nearly 80 years old, and vice versa. So this is important aspect of the immune system, which is still underappreciated by many immunologists, and we still have to learn everything. So it would be very dangerous to speculate too much, but I think so far we can say it's very important. We know it is important, but it has to be studied more.
And I think it's very important also for our listeners who might be panicking now about their pro-inflammatory antibodies to mention that glycan composition is not set in stone, but rather it's very, it can be very highly impacted by our environment and our behavior. So do you think it is safe to speculate that individuals who do have a higher pro-inflammatory action of their antibodies could potentially reduce it and reduce their risk of severe COVID through lifestyle and behavior?
We know that approximately 40% of this IgG glycan composition would be heritable. Heritable means it is something we got from our parents. We cannot change it. 60% is changeable. It's affected either by epigenetics or direct environment. So epigenetics is a kind of memory during most of our lifetime, including the prenatal life, where information from the environment, from our mother, is telling our immune system how to behave. And then this can be maintained for decades. And then there is environmental factors, meaning if we are overweight, the fat tissue, especially the old fat tissue, do not have maintenance mechanisms. Because until 50 years ago, nearly no one, not only humans but also animals, would maintain the fat tissue for several seasons. We would get fat in the autumn and then get very skinny by the spring. So there is no evolutionary pressure to develop maintenance mechanisms to preserve the old fat tissue healthy. What happened with the modern diet, that people kept accumulating the fat tissue without losing it in the winter. So that fat tissue starts to accumulate damage, oxidative damage, DNA damage, all types of damage, which promote inflammation. Because when there is damage, immune system comes and kills the damaged tissue, which promotes inflammation. So if somebody is obese, he's always very pro-inflammatory. Also, we are all very diverse. So evolutionary people evolved to use different type of foods. Some are more adapted to carbohydrates, some are more adapted to fat, some are more adapted to proteins. And there is no standard humans. And I think the best example how different we are is the pace how dietary recommendations actually change. Until a few years ago, carbohydrates were the best. You know, you have to eat healthy carbohydrates every morning. Now, carbohydrates are considered to be the worst. And for decades, fat was labeled as bad. Now, we think again, fat is good. But I think it's very individual. So some people can tolerate carbohydrates. Some people cannot tolerate some fats and so on. So we cannot make general conclusions, but we can know that if we are eating a diet which doesn't fit us well, it can also be pro-inflammatory. There is an extremely important element of microbiome, which we were also ignoring for decades because all bacteria were considered to be bad. We have to kill all bacteria, we have to live in sterile environment. But now we know that we cannot live in sterile environment. We are actually in symbiosis with our bacteria, and without our bacteria, we cannot survive. And now we learn even more about the viruses and millions of viruses which live in us, which are also symbiotic and help us control the bacteria. So if we mess up our microbiome, and the ultra-processed food is really messing up our microbiome, because if you think about food which can stay on a shelf for months without bacteria growing there, and if we keep eating that food, then these same preservatives which are killing bacteria in the food are killing bacteria in us. So we mess up our microbiome, we eat the wrong diet, we do not don't move, we don't use our muscles, which then again can get inflamed, and we can really increase the inflammatory levels a lot. So I think we can do a huge amount of damage to our immune system by doing these bad things. But then again, if we stop doing these bad things, then our immune system recovers. So we have clear evidence that losing weight is beneficial, that changing diet can be beneficial, but there is no magic diet. So there is no one diet which works for everybody. Physical activity is beneficial, but not too much physical activity. Because we were kind of, so media propaganda was claiming it's not a bad diet, it's that just you're lazy, that's the problem. So we were all taught, you know, you just have to sweat out the bad diet and then you can buy all the junk food, you can buy all the sugary drinks and processed food, just you have to go to the gym. But now we know this is not true. So you cannot sweat out the bad diet. And if you exercise too much, you're actually doing damage to yourself. And I think it's very clear when you think about the professional athletes. You know, professional athletes, they would be old in their 30s. Other people are considered very young in their 30s, but a 34-year-old football player is considered to be very old. Because if you use your body too much, you spend it. You can't use it forever. So too much exercise is not good. Too much food is not good. We need to do everything in moderation, and then our inflammatory levels go down and also our glycogen improves.
Now, we have all during COVID heard who the people with the most predispositions for severe COVID are. So obese people, whether it be older people, people with comorbidities. Does the same hold true when you're looking at glycogen composition?
It's highly correlated. So what we see is that, yes, older people, obese people, hypertension, diabetes, they all change glycogen in this pro-inflammatory direction. We are not fully confident which is cause and which is consequence. So obesity is driving pro-inflammatory condition, but also pro-inflammatory condition may generate unsatisfaction, which then drives kind of urges to eat to make yourself happy because you don't feel happy. So these things are bidirectional, but definitely what we have done in this pandemic is we made people more obese. So the BMI increased, especially in children, which is horrible. We put people under more stress, which is also horrible. So, and we made people unhappy. So all these things are affecting our health, and we are seeing the consequences. We are seeing the mortality rates going up, which we cannot explain. We are seeing drug abuse, violence, traffic accidents going up, which is all consequences of our decisions to fight the virus, not with our immune system, which would be the best way, but with some kind of restrictions, which actually at the end didn't do much, but they caused a lot of damage.
Arguably what we can improve on from our previous pandemic is developing a better patient stratification method, basically finding a way of distinguishing between patients who are likely to develop severe COVID or severe version of the disease and those who will most likely be asymptomatic or have mild symptoms. Do you think that implementation of biomarkers such as glycans has the potential of changing and prioritizing treatment as well as maybe amending some of the restrictions?
In principle, they could, but you know, we cannot use at the moment the global capacity to analyze the glycans, prevent them from being used as a global biomarker. But they could be used as a personal navigator. Because imagine if in spring 2020, there was a global recommendation, lose extra weight, eat healthy, don't be under stress, and moderately exercise. Then we would actually reduce the number of people at high risk. So we would not only stratify people, but we would decrease the total number of people who can have a severe disease. And the problem with motivating people to live healthy is that usually the reward comes after years or decades of making hard decisions. So I have to decide today to skip the dessert, to do a little bit more of exercise, to try to relax. These are all difficult things to do. And if I will see benefit only after decades, then I don't have to do it today. I can do it tomorrow, I can do it next week. So psychologically, these decisions are difficult. But if there is an objective evaluator, which will show you in a few months whether your hard decisions are actually paying back already, whether you have already decreased your disease risk, but not only for this single disease, for multiple other diseases, then people get more motivated. And the other problem is that, you know, whenever we look for an advice, we get advice for standard human. Standard human does not exist. There is no standard human. So, at the moment, there are some attempts to do things like a nutrigenomics, meaning we will look at your genes and tell you what to eat. These things still don't work. One day, maybe. But today, we do not have enough knowledge to say which genetic polymorphism will make a specific diet good for you. The only thing we can do is try and see whether something works for us. And we cannot see it by looking into the mirror because we cannot tell the difference between how we look now and tomorrow. So these biomarkers could actually help motivate people. And it works. So we are doing it already. So the glycans are being used as a personal navigator for longevity by, I think, over 15,000 people so far globally. And we see that people, when they get the feedback, they respond. So if something works, they keep doing it. If it doesn't work, they try something else. And eventually they find something which works. So at the moment, I see glycans more as this personal navigator. One day, they will become a routine blood test like HbA1c or CRP or such a thing. This will come. The problem is that the technology to analyze glycans is still not available in the routine labs. So the labs simply cannot do it, and the small number of labs which can analyze glycans definitely cannot analyze millions of samples which are being analyzed every day in routine labs. But in a maybe decade, a little bit more than a decade, this will become a routine test. And then what you said could be right. So people could actually, like now we check glucose, we check blood pressure to see the risk for cardiovascular diseases, for diabetes. We'll be checking glycans to see the risk of inflammatory problems.
Now, just to reiterate about what is it that makes glycans so suitable to be prognostic, potentially biomarkers, could you maybe also define the word, the term glycoforms, and how that makes glycans so suitable as biomarkers?
Glycans are chemical structures which are added to a specific site on a protein, which we call the glycosylation site. But different glycans can be added to a given glycosylation site. If we talk about IgG, if glycans has a salic acid on its top, it will become anti-inflammatory. So antibodies carrying these glycans will suppress inflammation. If glycans are made without salic acid, especially also without the galactose, they will become a more pro-inflammatory. So this same molecule will activate inflammation in this specific case by the lectin pathway activating the complement and then killing the target. That's very detailed and molecular. So this glycans decide the role of immunoglobulins. And the decision, how will glycan look like, is a very complicated decision. So our studies have identified over 40 different genes which work together to make this decision. And these genes are not genes which make glycans. They're not the assembly line for glycans. These are the genes which regulate our immune system. And then depending on what these glycans have to do, they will make a different glycan. For example, we have studied in three seasons patients with influenza. So patients who were hospitalized because severe pneumonia caused by influenza virus. And in the same time, we were looking at patients who were hospitalized with pneumonia, but caused by a bacteria. So the symptoms are the same. We'll have lung inflammation, it's pneumonia. But in one group of patients, this was caused by virus, and the other group of patients, this was caused by bacteria. So this is still unpublished, so you wasn't able to read that paper. But what we have shown is that glycosylation is different in these two pneumonias. So if patient goes to hospital, sometimes it's not so easy to know whether the inflammation is caused by bacteria or by the virus. You have to do some blood tests, and then often physicians are just guessing whether it's bacteria or a virus. But our immune system knows the difference. Our immune system somehow knows that the antigen which is dangerous is a bacterial or is a viral. And then it's making antibodies to be optimized for fight against viruses and fight against bacteria. Because we fight viruses and bacteria in a different way. Bacteria, we will attack bacteria directly, and then we will mostly eat that bacteria. So we will just engulf it and destroy it. When it is virus, we actually have to kill the cell which is infected, which is dangerous because, you know, you're killing your own cell. So you have to be very careful not to kill the wrong cell. An immune system is optimizing antibodies by putting different glycans, different glycoforms of this structure on the immunoglobulin. So this is also called alternative glycosylation. So putting different glycans to the same glycosylation site to generate a different molecule, which will do a different work. And also, we also did the COVID. We looked at the glycans in COVID, and they also change, but slightly different than in influenza. So in addition of telling a difference between the bacteria and a virus, also our immune system can say, look, this is influenza virus, look, this is a coronavirus. So these viruses are different, so we are fighting them in a little bit different way.
That was going to be my next question. I was wondering if the glycan patterns which predict severe COVID, are they similar to those which might predict severe influenza, or are they completely different?
We do not have a study in predicting severe influenza, so I cannot tell you that. I know that the changes which happen in severe COVID are very similar to those which predict severe COVID, but not exactly the same. There are some other aspects. So, you know, we have to be open and say that we still know very little about glycosylation in general, and also in glycosylation in immunity. And we also have to be frank and say that we know very little about our immune system. So most of the textbook knowledge is overly simplified. So we present it in a way that we can understand it, but the immune system is actually the most, one of the two most complex systems we have, because, you know, it kept us alive for millions of years against all the pathogens. And pathogens mutate like crazy, they multiply like crazy, they would really like to eat us, but then eventually we do manage to defeat them in most of the cases. And this is what our immune system does. And I think we still have to study it for decades before we properly understand all the aspects of the immune system.
In the review you mentioned with David Sinclair, you also talked about the importance of biobanking and preparing samples to be used in the future. Have biobanks of COVID samples been made during this pandemic, and are they already being used today to study it further?
So there are many biobanks of COVID patients. Even in our lab, we have a couple of thousand COVID patients with the different outcomes. And yes, it's very important to study it in the future. One of the problems there is we are neglecting all other diseases because this single one, which is actually not even so dangerous anymore. But I think it's a good example how we can learn a lot if we focus, if the entire scientific community is focusing on one problem. But there were problems in focusing because, you know, hundreds of thousands of papers were published in COVID. And I believe over 90% of them are total junk. They're simply not true. And I think what we have to learn from this pandemic is how to do better science, and even more importantly, how to use scientific information to make decisions. Because many things were done in the name of science, which had nothing to do with science. So the word science was misused by politicians, by companies to get their personal power or to get profits. And this is very dangerous because people are losing their trust in science. Because when you see science being misused, science, and you don't understand science, then you can't tell the difference between good and bad science. You just say science is bad. And I think this is what's happening now in a large part of the world, is that scientists are not trusted anymore, and this is not good.
Yeah, I think it's a really difficult problem for especially individuals who might not have a good background in science to distinguish what is true and what is, as you said, propaganda. But I think you are quite a unique guest, having had experience both as having served in the advisory panel during the lockdown in Croatia, as well as then also researching COVID. So you've seen it from both perspectives. Now, Croatia has had one of the strictest lockdowns at the beginning of the pandemic, and now is one of the more liberal countries. So what was it that led to this change in policy?
Spring 2020, we were all scared. So especially we who work on viruses for a longer time, we know how viruses can be dangerous and how deadly they can be. And then there was a novel virus with a lot of propaganda. Now we know it was propaganda coming out from China that it is dangerous. And most of the world shut down. And Croatia had one of the strictest lockdowns in March 2020. But then our government established the advisory panel, which was relatively large, and we started looking at the data. And very soon it was clear it's mostly older people who are at risk. And the second important element came from New York in April, showing that this virus is not that dangerous, but it is spreading extremely quickly. So we learned that over a third of population of New York was infected in these first few weeks of pandemics, meaning that it cannot be much worse than what already happened. And then we also did a large study to look for the seasonality of a virus, because we knew that respiratory viruses are generally seasonal. Nobody knew for COVID, but we did a study and we showed that actually hospitalized patients were recovering much faster when the spring came. So already in late April, early May, we made a decision to open the country. So by large, because of this study, which we coordinated for the seasonality, we managed to persuade our government that the summer will be safe, that opening in summer will not cause any damage. And then Croatia fully opened in May 2020, and we were one of the few countries in Europe which had a normal summer 2020. And during that summer, the research came from other parts of the world, which indicated that all these restrictive measures which were introduced were not really very efficient. So that even the shutting down schools, closing the public transportation, stay-at-home orders would decrease the speed of would decrease transmission by 15, 10, 20%. So you would not save anybody. You would just extend a period when they will get infected by a few days or a few weeks. So we were really actively opposing the pressure from outside. And there was huge pressure from the European Union that the all member countries should go to lockdown. And we managed to kind of sideline these requests. And Croatia never had a full lockdown. We only had one unfortunate decision to close restaurants and cafes, but this was some complex politics. But most of the summer, most of the winter, we were still able to live partly normally. And when we look at the final outcomes, so especially the first wave, so the winter 2020, we were one of the most successful countries in the world, partly because we didn't have a summer lockdown. So big part of population got some immunity from the small amounts of virus that was spreading during the summer. Then we were hit a little bit more by the Delta wave, because obviously this immunity was waning a bit. So then the Delta wave was not that good in Croatia. But at the end, now when we look a couple of years in the back, none of the countries who were imposing very strict measures really benefited. For example, Slovakia is a similar country to Croatia. They had very strict lockdowns. They were testing everybody with antigen tests very early. And actually, they had more people who died of COVID than Croatia. And while we had a similar problem with the virus as other countries, Croatia did not cause so much damage as some other countries. And when we look at excess mortality now, we are actually better in Croatia today than some other countries with her more strict measures. Because, you know, when you shut down the hospitals, when you scare your people, when everybody's afraid, when everybody is at home, you are not diagnosing cancers, you're not diagnosing diabetes, you're increasing the stress level, you're increasing the obesity level, and then it's driving morbidity and mortality for years to come. So we will be paying the price of lockdowns for years. So I think Croatia made a good decisions. I think it would be even better if we had less restrictions. So I think the Sweden did the best job. So when we look now, the Sweden, they did the best job. And yeah, nobody really benefited from the restrictions, and the damage is horrible.
With all of the information which we now have available about COVID-19, what are your thoughts about continuing vaccine mandates or limitations to enter countries based on vaccination status or universal masking?
Mandating a vaccine is a very radical decision. And we have to be very sure that there is huge benefit and very little risk. So the problem with this mRNA technology is that we still do not know all the risks. So it's really, it's not good to mandate when you don't know the risks. And the second aspect is, we have to, until the COVID, you would never vaccinate somebody who had the disease. Because it's just absurd. So if you had the disease, you develop immunity, why would you vaccinate? And we were mandating vaccination of people who were previously infected without any evidence of benefit and with known potential harm. And I think these were the wrong decisions. And universal masks can be beneficial in a short period of time, and if used properly, of course. So actually, I was one of the first people who were actively promoting and lobbying for the use of masks. But they're not efficient in the long term. So, for example, masks in schools are completely inefficient. No benefit. And there is harm. Masking even younger children, no benefit. And there is harm. So I think it's very important to balance benefit and harm. And we still don't know what is actually the harm of a long-term decrease in exposure to different environmental antigens. So we know that all organ systems in our body have to be active to develop. So if you don't exercise, our muscles deteriorate. If we don't use our brain, we are losing the cognition. So if we don't use our immune system, what happens with our immune system? And it's very, very risky to experiment on a population level. So what will happen in, for example, in US states which had a universal masking compared to states which didn't have it? We'll need years to see the consequences. So if somebody is mandating something, masks or vaccines or any other drug or anything, that person or an organization have to be very certain what are the consequences. And now we don't have that because we don't have sufficient science to say what is going on. And the decisions are mainly based on a lobbying. And the problem with lobbying is that the one who has more money has more lobbying power. And this is not the way how medical decisions should be made.
I agree. I think we are only now beginning to realize the damage that was potentially done, especially to children, both in their education as well as development of the immune system and just normal physical development. Hopefully not very severe. We'll see in the coming years. When it comes to research about COVID, especially research in your lab, what is next? What are the next open questions?
I think what we need to use this situation of so many people being infected, vaccinated, treated with different therapies, is to try to understand how immune system works. So we will definitely use these large cohorts of people which we have who were either infected or vaccinated and then infected and so on, to try to understand the basic functions of the immune system so that we know more when something like this happens again. Because, you know, viruses are evolving. So just, I think, a few days ago, there was a paper suggesting that the Omicron variant actually evolved in the mice. So not in some kind of South African human population, but in a mouse population. And we'll always meet new viruses. And a new virus can be a small threat or can be a large threat. Because we should not forget that the so-called Spain flu pandemic in the 20th century killed many people and killed many young people. For example, in my family, my grandfather lost, I think, two brothers and a sister in a week. And that was really horrible. So we have to be aware that viruses will evolve, that there will be new pandemics, and that we have to find a way how to use our immune system, how to help our immune system to fight the viruses and not destroy the society because we are afraid of a virus. Because if we do more damage with our response, then what is the benefit? We shouldn't be doing it. And I think now we have to look back and really decide what was good and what was bad and what we should be and what we shouldn't be doing in the future. And this is not an easy discussion or easy decision, because people invested a lot of their authority in specific decisions, and it won't be easy for them to change their mind. But good thing is that we have different countries which had a different response. Also, within US, we have different states with a very different response. So we can easily compare and actually make a good scientific conclusion what was good and what was not good.
Excellent. Thank you. I think this is a perfect place to finish our conversation today.
It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you very much for joining. Now, speaking to our listeners, I hope this conversation provided clarity for some lingering questions surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. If there is one thing I would like for you to take away from this conversation, it is that daily lifestyle and health decisions do matter and have a huge potential on reducing your susceptibility to infectious and chronic diseases alike. If you would like to access more information about this conversation and Gordon's previous work, follow the link in the description to the show notes for this episode. Equally, if you want to find out more about Glycan Age, head on to glycanage.com, where you can access a whole list of our scientific publications, blog posts, testimonials, and of course, this is where you can order your Glycan Age test kit. Watch out for our next episode, where I will be joined by Louise Newson, a renowned menopause specialist who is aiming to increase our knowledge about menopause and perimenopause. She also campaigns for better menopause care for all women. We will be unraveling the wider implications of menopause on health and its role as a female hormone deficiency. Please don't forget to leave ratings and reviews for this episode and engage with us on social media. Thank you for listening and have a great day.